Thank you again for coming to the talk today. And I think, you know, maybe if you talk to some of your friends before you decide to come to a talk on constipation, they may have looked at you and wondered why you'd spend the evening talking about such a thing. And constipation, very interesting topic. I think you guys will you'll hear some things you're not familiar with. I certainly learned a lot of things in getting this talk together for everybody, which is part of the enjoyment that I get from talking about any of these subjects, is going into depth a little bit more. And I like also some odd connections and interesting sidebars, and you'll hear some of those today. Things that I didn't know connected with constipation, some fascinating individuals like Donald Rumsfeld, among others, that are just oddities of how they might connect to the issue of constipation. The first thing I do when I come up with one of these lectures is I go to the internet, and all these slides, of course, are pictures off the internet, and I didn't get this fancy little picture, and you might get a chuckle out of it. The first thing I did was I Googled the term constipation, and if you guys are, you know, go on Google, you know that you can go under images as opposed to just the web, and then you can see what pictures might come up. So the first picture that comes up is this picture. I found it bizarre. I don't understand it. I don't understand why all the dots, all the periods between, it makes no sense to anything. And of course, McCain, I don't remember ever seeing this picture. I don't know, it's rather humorous. I'll show you a few others that came up during this survey of images for constipation. Some of them were sort of funny. This one was really cute. I have no idea what animal that is. I just thought it was bizarre. And you know, somebody said constipation. It's actually like number 3 on the Google. Go figure. All right, a few others. Here's one. I found that might have been how most of us maybe feel. It brings out the worst in all of us. Yeah, pretty true. No idea what kind of animal that is. And then, you know, I thought that this has been a problem that has plagued humans for centuries, you know, since the beginning of time. So I actually Googled constipation and caveman. And believe it or not, this comes up. Bizarre. Give you some perspective. I don't know what it means. He's sitting on a rock and he's a skeleton. I don't know. Strange stuff. But, you know, it turns out that, you know, I don't have any scientific basis for this next comment, although I generally like to have some scientific basis for the comments I make tonight. It turns out that I believe 100% of people have constipation. I'm guessing that's true, sometime in their life. I don't think that's probably a misestimate. And I love this lady having her birthday and lighting up her cigarette. It's rather ironic here. Interesting sidelight, if you look up Medi-Cal, which is the Medicare, or the California Indigent Care, they spend $15 million a year on visits for constipation specifically. Now, these aren't people who had other serious health problems. It's just the complaint of constipation. Sort of an interesting little number. Not like it's that costly or anything. The question then becomes, you know, what is normal? And we all wonder, are we normal? I mean, a lot of times people come to the doctor, am I normal? Something weird happened to me today, you know, maybe I need to see the doctor. Sometimes we, you know, ask a friend or maybe somebody we're living with, we're like, okay, and they're like, I've heard of that before, don't worry about it. But how many times in a week, I made a little fun, how many times in a year, who counts how many bowel movements one has in a week? If you're doing that, we'll talk about other psychological states that maybe we have to discuss. But it's really about what is normal. Now, normal is a term we throw about, and we use that term all the time, and, you know, and I think we all decide, we start out with the idea, well, my family's normal, and then we immediately get rid of that concept. We're like, my family's absolutely not normal, but that's normal. That's a normal not being normal. Normal, you know, is a distribution. You know, there's no perfect number of bowel movements to have in a day, although I think sometimes when I'm talking to patients, they think there is a number they're supposed to be hitting. There is not an exact number, and it is a distribution. Now, when I was in medical school, I was taught, and this is just absolutely word of mouth, this is what the GI doctors taught us, that the range of normal movements is, now this is of course not scientific at all, but this is 4 per day to as little as twice a week. That would be considered normal. Now, of course, normal is for the individual, you know, what a person experiences in their own, you know, pattern, if you will. This is how wide the range is. And so I think a lot of us, when we're starting to think, are my bowels working okay? It's like, there is a wide range. You know, people ask me this all the time. It's like, there's a very wide range. You're probably normal if it's not almost like to a crazy level, to be honest with you. But they have studied this, okay? And they actually did a study of 1,100 young adults. And this is what they reported. It was very interesting. These are young people in their 20s, okay? They just said, healthy young people, come and talk to us, tell us about your bowel habits. Or I don't even know that they said that when they recruited them. 86% of the bowel movements were normal among these people. So that means even among young people, about 14% of their movements they thought weren't right. whatever that means, okay? I'm not saying anything specific about that. 3% of the people, and these are healthy, normal young adults, not with diseases or any health issues, had more than 25% of their bowel movements, 3% had more than 25% of their bowel movements they would describe as diarrhea, 8% with constipation more than 25% of that, and this is 20-year-olds, okay? Now, this is bizarre facts, but these are absolutely what this study found. Whites reported more bowel movements than non-whites. Makes no sense, but this is what was reported. And part of this gets in, and men reported more bowel movements than women. It does get into this sort of very subjective sense of what we observe. And we've talked about this before in some of the other talks about how, you know, our observations of our own experiences may seem to us to be eminently perfect, but they're probably not so perfect. They can be very inaccurate. So, all right, so we're going to get scientific a little bit about this topic. They actually have, I mean, doctors, scientists get together, and they make up criteria of what constitutes constipation, okay? And this is, believe it or not, they had two versions before this that, you know, had gone on a few decades ahead. Can you imagine? So this is the Rome III criteria, all right? Now, the reason they do this, actually, it's important, and a lot of times this kind of commentary is taken out of context in other disease states. And I'll give you an example. For instance, a condition that's very hard to identify with any certainty. The Rome III criteria, we did hear about that, Rome 1 and 2. And this isn't about the pontiff or anything like that. My point was about these criteria. These criteria are set up for scientific studies so that one researcher, let's say in Italy, can do a research on the topic of constipation. And when another researcher, let's say in America or in another country, does that research, we at least think we're looking at the same people. And this was, a classic example would be something like a condition that maybe you all know of, fibromyalgia, okay? Fibromyalgia is a condition that's very hard to describe with any exact scientific parameters. And so there were some agreed upon criteria. Those were set up for scientists for study purposes. They then got into the general public as being the criteria for diagnosing fibromyalgia, which they're not meant to do, okay? So these criteria I'm not indicating are the absolute criteria, but I think they're a starting point and something to look at here. So straining during at least 25% of defecations, lumpy or hard stools 25% of the time, incomplete evacuation, a sense of obstruction or blockage. I think this is a lot of time what we envision, you know, that there's some sort of blockage, and we're going to talk about that, because I think that's where really people get sort of a bit anxious, worrying something's blocking the way. Manual maneuvers, we are going to get a little gross here, if you will, but I mean, we're talking about bowel movements. The interesting thing also about bowel movements is we all have our own experiences about bowel movements. We have, you know, thousands of those. We might have some of our partners. We have some of our children. That's sort of it. I mean, we have very little in the way of a vast experience. Of course, doctors, I end up talking to people about their bowels a lot, so I have a much wider range of what people think is normal or what they're experiencing. Fewer than 3 defecations per week, loose stools rarely present, and no irritable bowel syndrome. And that's a whole nother topic that we're going to sort of avoid. This discussion is not about irritable bowel. It's specifically about constipation. One of the questions is, what are we trying to achieve, you know, when we're trying to have a bowel movement? And the answer is, we're digesting our food, and we're trying to move it on through to the end and evacuate, okay? So one of the questions, which I think is just interesting because this comes up, people say, how long are my intestines? And this is not particularly controversial, but you can read differing things depending on what sources you look at. So we're going to talk about the anatomy of the GI tract. Okay, we start with the English version of esophagus, the O, stomach, duodenum. This is the beginning of the small intestine. Okay, this here is all the small intestine. The colon, or large intestine, what we call the transverse colon, the descending colon. This was the ascending colon. We have the sigmoid colon, the rectum, and anus, which is very specific, just that last little bit. So the question is, how long is this? So the small intestine is essentially 20 to 25 feet long, okay? Now, the purpose of the small intestine, which begins right at the end of the stomach, is to absorb nutrients. That's its primary purpose, 20 to 25 feet in length. And we'll talk a little bit about why it needs such length to do it, but it has to do with surface area. You need a lot of surface area to break down all these food products and absorb them adequately. The next is the colon, which is about 5 feet long. And I will tell you, in a autopsy specimen, the colon and the small intestine get larger and longer, to be honest with you, because the musculature is relaxed. All right, so that's 5 feet. So the total there, well, we got 20 plus 5 or 25 plus 5. We got 25 to 30 feet. So that's how far we're trying to move things along. So that's the answer. How long is the GI tract? 25 to 30 feet. Now, the cross-section of the bowel, one of the things I want to look at is, now, what is the bowel doing? And really, to talk about how we move things along, the muscles, I mean, we have muscles in our bowel that wrap around in two different patterns, in longitudinal and circumferential, back and forth and up and down, if you will, along the entire length of the intestine. This lining of the small intestine, just to make the point about why the small intestine is so very long, is because it's lined with the mucosa, surface tissues. Then on top of the mucosa are little fronds called villi, okay, which are not visible, but are visible microscopically. And then notice this, just for interest sake, on top of every one of these cells, once again, is microvilli. Sort of interesting. So not only do you have a long tube that has lots of surface area that's then covered with all these dimples, but the dimples got dimples so that everything gets absorbed. Right? So it's sort of amazing. The surface area is enormous in the small intestine. But we're looking at these muscle layers because this is what is going to propel the food through the intestine. And the term for that is, you guys remember this from grade school and high school, peristalsis. Okay, this is the muscular contraction, the coordinated muscular contraction that moves the bolus of food, as we say, this is a lovely scientific term, food bolus, quantity of food, propels it in a directional fashion, okay, by squeezing, relaxing, and so forth. Now, we're going to look at an example of peristalsis. So now we're going to watch a wave. This is in the stomach, but it could be in the small intestine. There's got a scope in here. So we're looking through a scope. You're going to see this. You're going to see it again in a moment. It's going to relax now, and then you'll see the wave occur. And it's not unlike, I would say, a wave in the ocean or a wave at a stadium. Okay? So these rhythmic contractions. Okay. These propel the material inside our intestine forward, okay? That's happening all the time. And of course, when you eat, that stimulates more of that, but that's peristalsis, okay? So that's in action. How long does it take for material to go from the mouth to the anus? Now, this is sort of standard fare for what a medical student will be taught, 72 hours. And this is the famous, I'm not sure who this character is, but of course, I was trained a little bit in Iowa too for 3 years and residency there. And so the famous Iowa corn count, which is, you know, people, I mean, this is a little bit of humor, but, you know, there's the old story, you know, you eat your corn and you'll see it later kind of thing. You know, it doesn't digest because it's fibrous. And we're going to talk about fiber, but it's a kind of fibrous material that's undigestible, essentially. So if you do that, you can actually, I mean, people have done this, of course, to try and see how long it takes. Here's just a little funny one, a giant ear of corn. But they actually do this concept in the real world. It's not done very often, but this is a transit study. So see these little markers? They look like little rubber bands, okay? So what they'll do is they'll feed these to somebody in a meal, and they'll say, come to the radiology center. We're going to take a picture. And then we're going to take a picture every hour, and then they're going to watch these markers march their way across and then come out. You know, then they could do much more accurate studies, okay? You're not like eating corn one day and checking your bowel movement in the toilet. I mean, you're actually, you know, feeding somebody this and then you're taking x-rays and watching the march of these things. So a transit study can be done. But just to show you the concept of what's going on, I think the biggest fear that anybody would have when they have constipation, which is actually somewhat of a myth, to be honest with you, is that they have colon cancer. Now, it's not impossible. I don't want to say that constipation cannot be a sign of colon cancer. It actually can. It rarely will be. In my experience, it almost never is. So people come with constipation, never have it. Now, this is a picture from a colonoscopy of a cancer, okay? Here, it's bleeding, irritated, I'm not sure why. But this is the cancer here, the tumor. Notice the entire opening here, the orifice here, still fairly large. Anything can move by this. In fact, if you talk to doctors who specialize, the gastroenterologists, or I've had patients, you can have this narrowed down to 2 millimeters, which is about a grain of rice opening, and still have normal bowel movements. In fact, I've seen it. I have patients still living today who have a narrowed colon to that amount, and they still can have a normal bowel movement, okay? Strangely, you wonder how it's possible, but it's absolutely possible. Now, this is another view that, again, you know, could constipation be a sign of colon cancer? Of course it could. Is it Rarely. So I think it's important to reassure people, because probably the most common thing people fear when they have significant constipation is, I have a cancer. You know, I think that's what's going on. In fact, that's probably one of the most significant things most people think when they come to the doctor. I wonder if it's cancer. And so the answer is, it almost never is, to be honest with you. Now, this is a different view. This is with a barium enema, where they put barium in the rectum, and then this is the radio opaque material, so you cannot see this. This is a classic. You almost never see this anymore. This was, you know, 40 years ago before the colonoscopy, before we had any way of identifying things, or people weren't as commonly seeing doctors. You'd see what's called an apple core lesion. It looks like the core of an apple here. And so this person has a circumferential cancer growing around the entire tubular structure of the colon, and it's leaving just a small opening in the center called an apple core lesion, seen on barium enema. Now, a person like this could have constipation. That is true. But it's extremely rare. So we don't start with that. We start with the idea that people do not have constipation from cancer. I mean, that is not my first thought when somebody comes in the door and says, I have constipation, okay? It's probably my patient's first thought, or often, but it almost never is. There are medical conditions that can cause constipation. Neurologic conditions, okay, multiple sclerosis, anything that affects the nerves that control the bowel can cause constipation. So multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, certainly a classic feature. One of the cardinal features of Parkinson's is slowness of movement, and it also applies to the bowel as well. Stroke, only because people aren't tending to or sensing as well. Spinal cord injuries, of course, they may not be sensing at all. Metabolic conditions. Now, let me just say that this is rarely the case. Again, rarely the case, but these are considerations of medical things. Medical conditions that can cause it. Diabetes, very advanced with many complications. Maybe kidney issues. Maybe. High calcium, very rare, but a possibility. Hypothyroidism, it has to be pretty extreme, not very mild. And then some other oddities or less common conditions. So not a lot of medical conditions that we think about with this. Probably more commonly, and this is maybe an area where the doctors fall by the wayside and don't quite do their job. Medicines, I tend to say the medicine didn't cause that, the medicine didn't cause that. And medicines actually are very safe and rarely causing a lot of side effects. However, certainly constipation. I mean, down here we have opiates. I mean, take a pain pill and get stopped up. Very common. Some blood pressure medications, calcium channel blockers, Norvasc, which is a very common one, Procardia, Verapamil. These things can slow the bowel. I want to make a point. Aluminum, which people don't think of, but is in antacids, okay, and calcium too. Calcium will cause constipation. So a lot of people, and bloating. People, a lot, you know, everybody's told you got to take calcium, particularly the women more than the men. Absolutely, probably one of the major causes of bothering people's bowels are calcium. Iron supplements, people know this. And then medications, antihistamines. I wouldn't say that so often. Antidepressants certainly can. Antipsychotics, these are medicines that you don't see in use all that much. Does anybody remember this fellow? Can anybody name this person based on this photo? If you can, you win all the prizes, because this is tough. Okay, now let's see if you can name him when I show you this. I don't know if this came from my childhood, but does anybody know this guy? Do you remember this guy? Yul Gibbons. Now Yul Gibbons, curious guy, he wrote a book that was famous called In Search of the Wild Asparagus. Okay, he was one of the first people to be interested in organic and natural foods. Okay, and that's why he got this gig for the Grape Nuts commercials, okay, back in the 70s. Where he made the point, he said, many parts of the pine cone are edible. Johnny Carson used to just have a field day with us. But the point is, almost anything is edible, okay? It's not digestible, okay? But it's edible. And we're going to talk about somebody who's got more going on with edible than Yule. But Yul Gibbons, the other thing that I thought was sort of curious when I read about Yul Gibbons' life, which of course came up in the research, is that like one of my heroes, these three men died of the same disease, actually. They all died of, which was common in the 70s. Both these men died in the 70s, 1970s, that is, aneurysm, all three of these, including Freud. So just sort of weird, great men. I don't know about Yul, but these two. All right. Now, speaking of anything's edible, this fellow, I don't know, unless you're watching some odd shows about odd people, Michael Lotito. He's a Frenchman, eats metal, glass, rubber, has eaten, and this is absolutely known fact, airplane, bicycle, shopping cart, I mean, piece by piece, of course. He's eaten this thing, okay? He lived until 57, so he didn't die young. Of course, he didn't digest any of it. It all came out. But the point is, you can eat anything. And this is what we're getting at with fiber, because when we're talking about fiber, we're really talking about something that's not really digestible, okay? So here is an example. These are the three main ingredients that we that are in the food when we eat something. We eat it because it's digestible. I don't know if anybody remembers the movie The Good Earth with Pearl Buck. Does anybody remember that movie? There's a famous scene where they're eating mud because they're so starving. You can eat mud, it will provide no nutrition. You will not digest it. You can eat an airplane, same thing. But these are the three items that we digest, okay? Here's carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, okay? And I just want to make a point, because this is going to come up in some of the other aspects of our discussion here, that carbohydrates, here's glucose, here's sucrose, which is a combination of glucose and fructose, and here's something called a complex carbohydrate. So you see, this is just one of these, you know. I mean, I don't know if you remember the old joke, do you know what this is? It's a flock of these, you know. So my point is, this is just a bunch of these together, okay? All right, same now here. So the digestion occurs in the body. The body wants to absorb this, so it breaks this apart. It cleaves this sucrose or sugar molecule apart. It takes this starch and it breaks it. It has special enzymes that allow it to break it and break it, and then each individual piece is absorbed, and thus you take your food and you digest it, okay? Here, too, is the protein, okay? Protein is a combination of simple chemicals called amino acids, okay? Amino acids, valine, leucine, tyrosine. There are 26 amino acids, okay, that form in different combinations, just like the alphabet, to make proteins. Okay, and so your body takes this long thing called a protein, and it slices it here, it slices it there, it slices it there in the digestive tract, and then it absorbs it. That's how you digest. Same thing here with fat. It cleaves these. It has special enzymes and ability to do that. But the one thing it can't do that to fiber. Okay, the body cannot digest fiber. That's what fiber is. It's undigestible organic materials. Okay, so now here is starch, and here is cellulose. Okay, starch is something you can eat. That's like potatoes or spaghetti. This is wood pulp, okay? To be honest with you, I couldn't find an exact copy that looked the same, but these structurally are identical, except for one thing, and I won't get into the chemistry too much. This bond here, okay, is slightly different than this bond here, slightly. The body cannot break that bond. That bond will go through undigested. So if you eat wood, it will not digest. If you eat a starch, your body will break it apart and digest it, okay? So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about fiber, okay? So fiber is probably the number one natural source of laxative. Our goal, supposedly, is to eat 25 to 30 grams of fiber a day. And just to remember, I like to sort of put it in context because it's so important when I say 50 grams, you're like, 50 grams? I have no idea. Is 50 grams a big bushel? Is it a tiny little thing? I have no idea what a gram is, okay? So a pound is 454 grams. A pound is 16 ounces. There are about 28 grams in an ounce. So, all right, so we need to have approximately an ounce of fiber every day, okay? Now, most of us are doing half of that, okay, in our diet. We're not eating enough fiber. And fiber is good for us. It's good in a lot of ways. But it's undigestible organic material. Now let's look at, here's a dietary fiber table in different servings. So you can see now why people rail against certain foods. People like polished rice, okay? People, you know, whatever polished is. I mean, it's been well trained and so forth, it's polished. No, but as opposed to people saying, well, you know, everybody loves to say, eat the brown rice, don't eat the polished rice or whatever, the white rice. And that's because there's a lot more fiber here. Way more. There's four times more fiber. Right, look at all these things that, you know, are these staples in American diet. Unfortunately, not great here in the fiber category. Spaghetti, just about none. Regular white rice, nothing. Macaroni, not much. Now, you get up to here, there's much more substantial amounts. Bran, look, wheat bran, it's got a lot. That's almost half your daily. Rolled wheats, whatever those are, I've never eaten them. Anybody ever eat a rolled wheat? Rolling them on the floor? All right, almonds. Okay, look at this. Interestingly, peanuts did pretty good. I was sort of impressed by that. I mean, I was sort of surprised at the different amounts of fiber. Let's look at some other things. Okay, vegetables aren't going to have much, obviously. Baked beans, now that has other gastrointestinal consequences. And what that is, just since we're talking about that, you know, why do baked beans cause gas? It's very simple. We understand this, okay? You guys understand this. basically, baked beans have certain carbohydrates that the body doesn't break down. It doesn't cleave them like we showed. Then they pass on into the small intestine where the bacteria that live there, they can cleave them. They can break them apart, and they digest them, and they create gas. That's why beans cause gas. Undigestible carbohydrate that the bacteria can digest. Okay, now look at this. So baked beans, gosh, they have a lot of fiber in them, surprisingly. Bran muffin, you know, people make fun of the bran muffin. I do. But look at it. A lot going on. A lot of, okay. Now we're going to get to a little more substantial here. Fresh fruits have some, certainly. Now here, notice the prune, the happy prune, which of course is probably one of the staples of the constipated person's diet. This is why it's so good for you. It has way more fiber than anything else. Same thing with dates, actually. So interesting just to see the different amount of fiber in these products. Now, this is what you would have to eat to ingest that 25 to 30 grams that we talked about. Sort of surprising. Okay, 22 prunes. That's probably doable. Okay. Maybe not. Maybe it isn't doable. I've never tried it. Does anybody know the most prunes they've ever eaten? Can anybody relate how many prunes they've eaten in a sitting? 2 ounces of wheat bran. That sounds doable. Interestingly, even all these supplements, we're going to talk about all the supplements. They're different. They're each of them different. 7 servings of Metamucil. That's a lot. 12 servings of Citrusel. Wow. 25 of Fibercon. Who knew? And the point is, when you take the supplement, they improve your fiber, but they're not achieving your fiber content. You really need to eat it. It really needs to be in your diet. All right, so we're going to talk about the first of the fiber products ever invented, the first bulk fiber. Okay, that was Metamucil, okay? And is that, everybody's familiar with this. This thing's been around forever, been around since the 1920s. It was the number one selling laxative in 1934, as it turns out. It's made from psyllium husk, and now there's a connection of psyllium husk to our lives here in Phoenix, Arizona, for a reason. Psyllium husk is a grass. Psyllium is a grass grown in India. 85% of all psyllium still comes from India. They tried to grow it in Phoenix, Arizona. They thought they would move all the psyllium production and growth here to Phoenix, Arizona, because the weather in Phoenix is very similar to the weather in the areas of India where psyllium grows. However, the weather here wasn't conducive because hail and other, I guess, harsh storms and winds destroyed this grass crop. It's fairly fragile. So as a result, India still is the major producer of psyllium husk. Okay. Now, of note, the drug company that invented and made its mint on this amount of, on this product, Metamucil, was Searle, G.D. Searle, out of Chicago. This man ran the company for 8 years, sold it to Monsanto, who then sold it to Procter & Gamble, and unbeknownst to everybody in this room, except for Elena and Nan, Metamucil is, all the Metamucil, I believe, in the world is made in Phoenix, Arizona. Yeah, at a very high-tech plant in West Phoenix. There it is, Googled. I Googled the plant right there. It's very unpretentious, but that's where all the Metamucil in the world is made. And the reason it's here is because Procter & Gamble brought all of their equipment here because they were going to process a psyllium that was going to be grown in Phoenix. And yet they didn't grow it in Phoenix, but they left the manufacturing plant here. Okay. Now, fiber is not all the same. Okay, so let's talk about the next fiber that's probably the other one, that probably the other big brand is Citrusel. Now, Citrusel is not psyllium husk, which is an undigestible carbohydrate. It's methylcellulose, which is essentially wood pulp. Process somehow. I'm not sure exactly how it is. This is what it looks like. Remember, it looks like those carbohydrate chains we looked at before. Believe it or not, weirdly, the primary constituent part of KY jelly is this material, the same material. I don't understand how that's true. It is absolutely the truth that Citrusel is the same thing as KY jelly. And KY jelly is not Kentucky jelly, as somebody told me. In fact, the name KY jelly invented in 1904, and nobody knows why it's called KY jelly, apparently. There's no answer to the question, why is it called KY jelly? Because a lot of people ask me, why is it called KY jelly? I don't know, and nobody apparently knows. Okay, but it's not Kentucky jelly. All right, Citrusel. The next one, this one's going to get, it gets weirder. Okay, Fibercon is calcium polycarbophyll, okay, which doesn't sound particularly pleasant. Now, look, I recommend this product to people. I do tell people, well, you can get Citrusel, you can get Metamucil, you can get Fibercon or Benefiber. This is different. Notice this, it looks chemically very different, okay? But it absorbs a lot of water, one of the features of fiber, okay? These are what we call soluble fibers, okay? Which means they absorb water. That's how they work. They don't get digested. They stay in the bowel movement. They bulk it up, as we've heard, and they absorb water. Believe it or not, this is the constituent of diapers, of baby diapers. This is because it has such high absorption rate for water. This is FiberCon. It's baby diapers. I can't understand this. I'm not kidding you. Okay, finally, we're talking about Benefiber, which is something you guys have probably heard the term of because you see this in your food all over the place. Guar gum. Guar gum. Now, guar gum comes from the guar bean, of course. Where else would it come from? Which I don't know. It's grown in India and Pakistan, again, another one of these things. You know, that's why we sailed. Columbus sailed, you know, to get the guar bean. And again, look at it. It looks just like those others. I mean, it's a carbohydrate, but your body can't break it down. It doesn't have the enzymes, the ability to break these various bonds. And so it will be, it will remain undigested. Now, guar gum's in a lot of foods you eat. It's a preservative. It's a thinning agent. It's in shampoos. It's in a lot of things. It's sort of interesting. Now, we're moving on. Okay, so that was fiber products. They work by being undigestible. They're soluble, so they add water, and they bring in water and make moisture to the bowel movement, which makes it easier to move along through peristalsis. Okay, here is stool softeners. Okay, that's probably the next thing. And these things also add water to the bowel movement. Colase, docusate sodium, Surfact. There's really, I think there's only one stool softener, and that is docusate sodium, as far as I could find out. Now, curiously, the reason I have this little image down here of the oil rig, the Deepwater Horizon, is that this is a kind of chemical called a surfactant, which means it reduces the tension between, or it allows water to mix with solid materials. Okay, it's a surfactant. And it turns out that this is the same chemical that was thrown on the water, among the chemicals used, to disperse the oil spill. Stimulant laxatives. These are a totally different group. Talk a little bit about, okay, so these are all the big stimulants that we know of. They all work similarly. Okay, they all work similarly by getting those nerves that line the intestine to work harder, to move things along more, to make that peristalsis action go stronger. Now, the original one was Ex-Lax, okay? And they, now, Ex-Lax is still around, of course, but does everybody know that Ex-Lax has been reformulated to be Senecot? It's essentially Senecot now. It used to be a chemical called phenolphthalein. Phenolphthalein. Phenolphthalein was mostly erroneously thought to cause cancer. There is very meager evidence to this effect, but it was taken off the market and Ex-Lax had to reformulate to Senecot, okay, Sena. Castor oil coming from the castor bean. These are all different chemicals, Dulcolax, bisacodyl. Aloe vera, which I'm not a huge fan of the natural products, to be honest with you, but aloe vera has a similar chemistry and effect. Cascara, also another natural product that people know of, okay. These are all medicines that work by enhancing the nerves that line the intestine, these nerves that are right by the muscle fibers, to enhance their activity and thus enhance peristalsis and move things through. So that's how stimulant laxatives work, very differently. They work through the autonomic nerves, through this nervous system called the Auerbach plexus. Okay, so the nerves control the bowel. Of course, we all know that. You get nervous, your bowels get all funny. You know, you get really anxious. Some people, that's where they feel their anxiety, in their bowel. Okay? So this is what's going on, okay? All right, now one of the conditions you can get, which you may have been told you have this, you may have heard this, maybe you had a colonoscopy. I'll bet almost everybody here has had a colonoscopy, almost everybody here. But one of the things they might say you have, which is completely inconsequential, is a condition called melanosis coli. Has anybody ever been told they have melanosis? It sounds terrible, it's absolutely inconsequential. Your bowel literally, rather than looking like this, okay, which is nice and pink, has this dark pigmented stippling. It can be very dark, okay? Looks terrible, so to speak. I mean, it looks very abnormal. This is inconsequential and benign. This comes from overuse of stimulant laxatives, okay? There is an actual material that's taken up in the bowel, but it doesn't do anything to the bowel. It doesn't injure it, doesn't harm it in any way. But you will frequently hear somebody will say, oh, the person had melanosis, wink, wink, they use a lot of laxatives. It's like, and I don't know if that's even true, to be honest with you, although we say it. If we see melanosis on a colonoscopy, the presumption is that person uses a lot more cathartics and stimulant laxatives that we give them than they claim. Okay. The next type of laxative that we use are, of course, the very famous milk of magnesia. We'll talk a little bit about the history of that. Magnesium citrate, Epsom salts. You know, the old Epsom salts, everybody's getting them to put their foot in it to soak a bunion, but you can use it to as a laxative. Okay. and Fleet's phosphate soda. Now these work in a very different fashion, okay? These draw water in, okay, through a process we talked about in the first lecture about, or the first talk about water, okay? Osmosis, which is the passive motion of water from its high concentration to a lower concentration. This would be the chemical, the magnesium hydroxide inside the bowel wall. Water will move towards it, okay? It will move towards it to try and equalize the amount, the concentration of water on either side of this membrane, which is the lining of the cells of the bowel. So basically what happens is you take in milk of magnesia, inside your bowel lumen, or the opening, is a concentrated salt solution of a sort, magnesium salt, and water moves right in because it moves towards that, okay? Because it's passively drawn towards it, and then you move water into your bowel. And then, of course, you overwhelm the amount of water that your bowel can absorb, okay? And you evacuate, okay? So now, milk of magnesia is sort of interesting. I just thought I'd tell you the history of it. The first time it was ever used was in 1829. Treatment of this fellow, the Marquis of Angsley. Now, if anybody knows their British history, he was the cavalry leader at Waterloo for under Wellington, okay? So the fact that he basically gave the okay to this, like, made it a very popular item in England, okay? It got his doctors knighted. And interestingly, this man was so famous that his leg, which was shot off at this Battle of Waterloo, was actually a tourist attraction for decades in France, to go visit his leg. Weird. 1873, though, welcome to America. Here we go. Charles Henry Phillips of Stamford, Connecticut, invented milk of magnesia in the blue bottle. And I wonder if anybody here has ever seen it in the original blue bottle. Anybody? Yeah? Okay. I mean, it's still in the blue plastic bottle. But anyway, so milk of magnesia. This is the history of milk of magnesia. It goes back over, it's a 150-year-old laxative. Here's another one. Working in the same fashion, it works through the osmosis process that we talked about again. Okay, this one's called lactulose. This is one the doctors will prescribe. Notice it's like a sugar. Okay, it's just a sugar. We can't break it apart. As a result, it gets into the intestine and draws water in. Okay. Sorbitol. Now, this is interesting. Sorbitol is a non-absorbed sugar, and you'll see this everywhere in food. In fact, famously, it's in Orbit gum. And notice sorbitol, Orbit. That's where the name comes from, I presume. So it has a non-absorbed sugar, okay? Just as in sugar-free candies, you know, you'll see that. People say, oh, I can eat all of these. I can eat thousands of these sugars. They're not absorbed. Well, that's good news. They will cause diarrhea. Bad news. Because they're not being absorbed, okay? So they will do just like the other cathartics or the saline-type laxatives, osmotic laxatives. They'll go into the intestine, water will move in, and then they will create extra water that the bowel can't absorb and create a laxative effect. So that's sorbitol, and it's in sugar, all the sugar-free gums. It's in hard candies, and it's actually listed, if you ever eat something that says, like, it has an alcohol sugar in it, that will be a non-absorbed sugar, similar to sorbitol. You eat enough of that, Kashi Goline, anybody here love Kashi Goline? It should make you get gassy and really move, because it's got non-absorbed sugar in it, okay? But it won't tell you that on the box. It's all natural sugar, yeah, but it's naturally going to give you a laxative effect. Here is probably, this is the newest addition to the pantheon of laxatives, and very, very commonly used now, Miralax. It really is, now, this is the dreaded Go Lightly bottle, okay? If anybody's ever had to use one of those, that's dreaded. You see that, you're like, no, please, not the colon. This is why people don't want to do their colonoscopies, because of Go Lightly. Now, Go Lightly is made of this material called PEG, polyethylene glycol. It's just ethylene glycol. It's just a small little carbon fragment that's just put together in a long chain, okay? And it's almost like a plastic, really, if you will. Very fine, though, and very soluble. Very safe. It's been studied. Very safe. Okay, so instead of taking a giant quantity to cleanse your bowel and completely empty it of everything, you take a little quantity each day and you get your bowel moving. It draws water in and it makes the bowels go. Now, the reason Go Lightly was invented, and I don't want to add to new fears of that people could have in the doctor's office, was this issue that happened a lot in the 80s when we first started doing colonoscopies, colonic explosion during polypectomy. Okay, this happened early on. What would happen is they just invented the colonoscope and were starting to do treatments trying to remove polyps and so forth. And they, of course, realized unfortunately, in certain cases, that there was explosive gases in the colon. Okay, as a result, a gastroenterologist from Houston, Texas, Dr. Fortran, invented Go Lightly in about 2 days because he knew everything there was to know about rectal gas, and he knew how to get rid of it. And he invented PEG, polyethylene glycol, which is Go Lightly, and in 2 days, and it became, I mean, it's an industry. And he invented it in 2 days when they said, you know, we got to have something that stops these explosions. The takeaway points for today: constipation, extremely common. We tend to misestimate our bowel frequency, just the comment from the students, the younger people. Very rarely is there anything serious going on when you have constipation. I don't want to say never, okay? If it's really bad, you're going to have some pretty intense pains, okay? Almost never going to be something that serious. Look at the medications. Always look at your medication list. That's going to be probably your most common cause of issue. Fiber, helpful in managing the issue. And chronic cathartic use, okay, you saw that melanosis coli business, the stimulants, is not ideal, but it's not dangerous as a general rule, unless you're drinking bottles and bottles of milk and magnesia every day to go. Modest amounts used regularly are okay. And that's the end of the lecture. And, all right, that's it. I won't do the last slide. All right, that's it. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. So I want to see if there are any questions.